Shechachma for Parshas Vayechi. So let's start from the beginning. If you open up the Chumash, Vayechi Yaakov Beretz Mitzrayim, and the Meshech Chachma is looking for a deeper meaning to Vayechi Yaakov. What does it mean that Yaakov is alive? You know, life could be understood in a physical, material world, in a finite world, or it could be understood in something greater. Ha'inyan, what's going on here, is Sheha Adam Yesh Echad Shechai Li Atzmo. He says some people are good for themselves, you know, they care about themselves, they watch their health, they study what they have to study, and they support themselves. However, Yesh Chai L'Bnei Beiso, there are those who have a family, and they're able to contribute something to their family. And if in their demise after their passing, the B'nai Beiso will obviously be in sorrow and grief. Yesh Chai L'Iro, some people contribute to the entire city. And Yesh, and there's a final level, the most paramount level, is Chai L'Chol HaOlam. The entire world is at loss if this person goes. V'al Zeh Nemar, the Pasuk says in Mishle, V'tzadik Yisod Olam, which means that a true tzaddik, the entire world really depends upon him. So his life is a life for the entire universe. The Yaakov Avinu, lo be'iro levad hoyechai, v'lo be'eretz Goshen levad. Yaakov Avinu didn't live for the sake of his city, and only for the sake of his city, nor for the sake of his country, which was now Eretz Goshen, but rather something greater than that. Rak b'chol Eretz Mitzrayim. And the Meshech Chachma is going to try to prove how Yaakov Avinu is the life of the entire land of Mitzrayim. Everybody depends upon him. And so Eretz Mitzrayim represents, in a sense, the civilized world of that time. It's representative of the entire globe. And Yaakov lives for the entire globe. The life of the entire globe, in a sense, he's like Hercules holding up the entire world. And that's why Yechi Yaakov, be Eretz Mitzrayim. Be Eretz Mitzrayim means for the sake of Eretz Mitzrayim. And Eretz Mitzrayim depends upon him. With his loss, there's a tremendous despair for the entire land of Egypt. And how does the Meshech Chachma know this to be true? So this is based on various sources in Medrash. Hainu shepasak harav mi Mitzrayim, that when Yaakov came down to Mitzrayim, the famine terminated prematurely. It was meant to last for a full 7 years, but only lasted for those 2 years, because Yaakov came down to Mitzrayim. And what that means is shebirech leparo. When Yaakov comes down and meets Paro in Mitzrayim, he blesses him. And what is the content of his blessing? Sheyale hayor b'shvilo, that the Nile, which is basically the source of water to irrigate all of Egypt, will rise for Paro. You know, Paro used to go out every morning to the Nile. And as a result of Yaakov's blessing, although the Nile hadn't risen for years because they were in such a state of famine, and yet, after Yaakov's blessing, the power was that Paro would now be able to go out and see how the Nile would rise for him. And this is a comment of the Medrash on the Pasuk in last week's parasha that describes Yaakov standing in front of Paro. Vayavarech Yaakov es Paro. What was the content of that bracha? It was Sheyala Nilus Leraglov, that the Nile would rise to his feet. And therefore, says the Meshech Chachma, Zeu Sha'amru, and that's what the Pasuk means. In the very next chapter here in Vayechi, it says, Avel Kaved Zeh Limitzrayim. It was an amazing thing that all of Egypt was in a state of mourning at the loss of Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov Avinu did not only have a contribution to himself, his family, to Eretz Goshen, his nation, but also to the globe, to the world of that time, V'lo l'eretz Goshen bilvad. Shechazar hara'ov l'mkomo achar p'tiros. Now why were the people so depressed in the aftermath of Yaakov's passing? Because, say Chazal, that the ra'av, the famine, returned after Yaakov died. So as long as Yaakov was alive, that very heavy famine of the 7 years that was predicted, that would terminate prematurely. But years later, so I would say, let's figure it out. So we're talking about 2 years into the seven, and Yaakov comes down for another 17 years. So we're talking now a full 15 years later. 15 years later, Yaakov passes away, and Shuvpam, again, there's a ra'av, a famine that strikes the land. And this is all based on a Sifri, which you'll see quoted by Rav Kuperin in number 3, Rav Asi Omer, Kevin Shemes Yaakov, Chazar Harav Liyoshna. The Ra'av went back to what it was before.
So 5 more years.
Correct. 5 years would go by. At the end of that period, Yaakov Avinu would be alive for 17 years since the time that he arrived. And therefore, at that particular time, there'd be another Ra'av. I don't know, do me a favor, or if you tell this lady where she could sit, maybe, if you don't mind. She's a little embarrassed, maybe. Okay, then? All right, good. Yes?
Is the cover that Yaakov gathered, do the things that he did, or just his persona? Was it just his national presence gave him such kavod in the land? Or was he active? Did he do things like Yosef? Did he plan or minister or teach people?
We don't know that he was in any way, you know, a teacher or a guide. He was a guide to Yosef, of course, but we don't know of his impact on Mitzrayim. But we know that the entire land of Egypt recognized Yaakov's greatness, and the fact that the famine terminated when Yaakov got down to Mitzrayim prematurely by 5 years. And the clincher was that when Yaakov died, which is 17 years after he got to Mitzrayim, boom, they got hit again with a ra'ah. Now it's very interesting. By the way, Rav Daniel, if you want these 2 pages just to see the Meshech Chochm inside, don't think I'm going to cover all those pages, but I always give a little bit of a far of a photocopy. In any event, it's very interesting that with Yaakov's death, the brothers are overwhelmed by fear. And before the Meshech Chochm came along, everybody thought that the fear of the brothers of Yaakov was because now that Yaakov died, Yosef would take revenge against his brothers. But in the light of this statement of the Meshech Chochma, that the entire Mitzrayim was in Avelus, Avel covered al Mitzrayim because the famine returned, now there was another reason why the brothers were nervous. They were nervous because Yosef would not be able to sustain them as he had done all along, but that was only during the lifetime of his father Jacob. With Jacob's demise, it would be impossible for Yosef to sustain his brothers because the famine returned to the land, and there was no longer Yaakov alive to bring that bracha. Whole new pshat in what was going on. V'lachein, continuing, he gives an example from Rabbeinu HaKadosh. The Yushalmi tells us about Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, the great king of Israel, the leader of Israel. Kori Anafshe, he called about himself, V'chaye Yehuda Yudzayin Shana Bit Tzipori. Now Rabbi Yehuda Nasi lived in a city in the north called Tzipori, and really, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was in charge spiritually of sustaining the entire nation of Israel, not just the people of Tzipori. Says the Meshech Chochma, if you learn that Yushalmi well, the correct interpretation is Hainu Shemian Venuso, because of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's great humility, Hiktin Kvodo, he lowered his glory. And he wrote, as if he lived only for the city of Tzipori. And this is another example of a person who really, through his lifetime, gave spiritual sustenance, a lifeline, to the entire world. And yet, Rav Yehuda Nasi says about himself, the city of Tzipori. It's kind of like the Vilna Gaon. He came from the city of Vilna, and the city of Vilna is famous in Jewish literature for the Vilna Gaon. But in truth, the Vilna Gaon gave life for many generations, way beyond the confines of the city of Vilna. But many times we call the name of a city after a certain person. Like, for example, if I would ask you, what is the city of Radin known for? The answer is the Chofetz Chaim. The Chofetz Chaim came from Radin. But the Chofetz Chaim was greater than the confines of Radin. And he had an influence on the entire world until this day and way beyond. He gives another example. Another great is Rabbi Chanina. And Rabbi Chanina in the Yushalmi in Kelayim Tzavach, he gave out a yell, a scream, a krechts when Rabbi Yehuda Nasi died. Eilachem ubros shebe'eretz Yisrael. What about the fetuses, I don't know the plural, there were fetus in Eretz Yisrael, meaning that as long as Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was alive, there was a protection for every single last uberes, every last fetus. Hare Kvodo, we see from the Yushalmi that the honor and the glory of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, Higin al Kol Eretz Yisrael, not just on Tzipori, but in his humility, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi took pride and claimed the city of Tzipor, but really his influence went way beyond. Vizeo, and this is the new light on the Pasuk, which we'll see in the next chapter, Ro'ach Yosef Kimeis Aviyem. What was the apparent phenomenon that existed in that came to being at the time of the death of Yaakov Avinu? That Ro'ach Yosef Kimeis Aviyem. What all of a sudden did they become aware of, they became known of? Hainu, Shechazar Harav Limkomo, that the famine returned to the land of Egypt. And therefore, Yosef had to calm down the brothers and say, you know, somehow we'll find a way of sustaining you and you'll be able to survive. But they were very nervous about that. And therefore, when Chazal say that they were afraid in front of Yosef, it wasn't that they're afraid that Yosef would take revenge against them, they were afraid that Yosef wouldn't be able to support them now that Yaakov Avinu had died. Now, as I've mentioned to you many times, Rabbi Meir Simcha, amongst his unique features, his ability to interpret a pasuk in a very new way, and based on Chazal all over the place, he's aware of the Sefri, he's aware of every single Medrash, of every single Gemara, both Bavli and Yushalmi. But in addition, he has a unique ability to take an interpretation and put it in suspension, meaning put it in the back burners, and start from scratch again, and begin anew. And that's exactly what he's going to do here. Why is it that Mitzrayim is in a state of aninus or avelus after the death of Yaakov? I don't know whether to make a shachiyana or not. It's more than 30 days, but we spoke on the phone. Odye Shlomar, I have another answer to the question why the tremendous grief in Mitzrayim at the death of Yaakov. Yodua, it's a well-known principle, Dekever Tzadik Mechaper. Now, in order to appreciate those three words, of Kever Tzadik Mechaper, we have to know something about a Gemara in Sota. There's a Gemara in Sota which talks about a location called Pa'ar. Does anybody know where that was? It was in the Midbar, correct? And what happened at that location? Many bad things happened amongst them. The Jews worshipped Pa'ar. And the women of Moab somehow enticed them to worship Pa'ar. So they were guilty of idol worship. And the pasuk goes out of its way to tell us that Moshe Rabbeinu was buried near Pa'ar, in a location contiguous to Pa'ar. And Chazal say that this leads us to a principle called Kever Tzadik Mechaper. If a giant is buried in a certain place, I don't mean a physical giant, then his burial place generates a kapara. Now that could be understood in two ways. One way is to say that when a person is buried, his soul, his neshama, somehow hovers over the place of his burial, and that's where he prays to God, and anything that took place or any danger that might arise within a certain radius of that place, he's praying on that behalf. So on a yearly basis, Chazal say that there's a heavenly judgment against the Jewish people every single year because of the worship of Pa'ar. And Moshe Rabbeinu comes out of his kever, so to speak, his neshama comes forward and prays and supplicates in front of God to save the Jewish people. So that's called kever tzadik mechaper. I'll tell you a story.
Isn't it different for Or entirely? They weren't in
the different North then?
Different than where they sinned with Midian, because Midian is further, way further south.
I don't know, you'd have to look it up. If you have a Gemara in Sota, I didn't have a chance to go through the Gemara in Sota, I'm just trying to get through the Meshech Chachma, you'll take a look. And I want to tell you a little story that I heard from my Rebbe. He said that there was a great Frenchman, a Jewish man by the name of Rothschild, you all heard of him. And he was a tremendous philanthropist, and he contributed to French society. De Gaulle always considered Rothschild as a great, loyal Frenchman. Now, if you know anything about French nationalism, you'll know what I'm talking about. When Rothschild died, he left the Tzava, he left the last will and testament that his remains be brought to Eretz Yisrael to be buried here in Israel, for Kakava. And the first comment that came out of Charles de Gaulle's mouth when he heard about this was, "I thought he was a loyal Frenchman." Why do I tell you this story? Well, first of all, it's an interesting piece of history that despite Rothschild's contribution to French society, he always saw himself as a Jew first. And when it came to burial, he wanted to be buried in the Holy Land. But I'm telling you for another reason, because this is a concept called Kever Tzadik Mechaper, that from de Gaulle's perception, it was very important that the remains of Rothschild be buried in France. The Adua the Kever Tzadik Mechaper Umatsanu Li Yirmiya Shaholach al Kivre Avos. When Yirmiyahu HaNavi heard about the Churban HaBayis that was impending doom, immediately he goes to the Kever of Avos and he prostrates himself in Chevron on the Kever of Avos, because in that place the neshama of the dead is able to bring about a Yeshua, some sort of salvation, by praying to the Almighty. So Yirmiyahu went to the Kevri Avos to, so to speak, wake up the Avos and say, "This is a time we need you critically." The Kavar Moshe, the Kever Moshe Mechaper al Avon Pior Kemamara Besota. Okay, he quotes the Gemara in Sota Yudalid. V'zeu Sha'amra Avel Kaved Zebe Mitzrayim. Why? Because just like Rothschild, where did he command his remains to be buried?
In Israel.
Now, Yaakov Avinu was a very loyal patriot to Mitzrayim, and yet his last will and testament was, "Take my remains and bury them in Eretz Canaan." Hainu, Masha Ein HaKever Mitzrayim. They were very upset because they thought that Kever Yaakov Mitzrayim would somehow protect them. Now, the truth be told, personally, I'm just saying, Azariah Berzon, I like the creativity, but I don't buy into the second shot of the Meshech Chochmah. Do you know why? Do you really believe for one moment that the Mitzrim knew the Gemara in Sota, that they knew the Chazal about Moshe Rabbeinu, that they appreciated the Pasuk in Yirmiyahu, that Yirmiyahu went out to the Kever Avos? Were they aware of all this, I wonder? And did the Mitzrim feel depressed because Yaakov Avinu was not being buried in Eretz Mitzrayim? So you have to be a little bit creative and think out of the box to believe that the Mitzrim, but the first shot that the Mitzrim recognized the greatness of Yaakov Avinu, that's absolutely clear. There are many, many reasons why I believe that the Mitzrim respected Yaakov. Paro had a great deal of respect for Yaakov. Yaakov was the father of Yosef, and they worshipped Yosef. Anything that he did, they quickly believed in him. And I'll go even a step further. I would suggest to you that according to the Meshech Chochmah, Yaakov Avinu had an impact on Mitzrayim not only in the physical material sense, which means in terms of the Ra'av, but also in the spiritual sense, or in the ethical sense. Yaakov was an ethical paradigm for the people of Mitzrayim. And why do I say this? It may sound like a wild idea. What impact did Yaakov Avinu have on Mitzrayim? So let me talk to you about the following question. How many years did Yosef live under the influence, with a constant contact with his father Yaakov? Let's count. How old was Yosef when he was sold as an Eved?
17.
17. How many years did Yaakov live in Mitzrayim? 17. So is it coincidental? I don't know. You know, I'm not into gematrios, but maybe it's more than interesting. Yaakov Avinu chose Yosef ki benz kunim hu lo, and the Rabban says he was the zikna, he was the person, Yosef, that would receive the transmission of Torah from Yaakov. Chazal tell us that the entire corpus of Torah that Yaakov had received was transmitted to Yosef, including the secrets of the Torah like Hanukkah and Purim, which are not anywhere in Tanakh. They're purely Torah Sheval Peh. Now, how many years would it take Yosef to, in a sense, soak up the influence of his father Jacob to the point that he's ready for the greatest challenge in his life, to be sold to Mitzrayim? How many years would that take? When did Hashgacha see to it that in the divine scheme of things, Yaakov had managed to serve as a teacher for Yosef and pump up Yosef with such a spiritual, ethical power and strength that now he's ready for the greatest challenge of his life? How many years would it take?
17
years. Now, where do I see that? I'm looking towards the door, if anybody knows what I mean. Where do I see the impact of Yaakov on Yosef when he faces the greatest challenges in Mitzrayim? Excellent, Eishes Potiphar, because he looks towards the door, towards the window, and he sees Dvus Diyukno Shel Yaakov. So there's no question in my mind that Yaakov's continuous influence on Yosef was because he fortified him within those 17 years to face all the challenges. So why now does Yaakov have to come down to Mitzrayim for 17 years, the last 17 years of his life? From the perspective of Yosef, Yosef once again has to be a student of his father Yaakov. In what sense? After all, Yosef had already sat at his father's footsteps for, as father's feet for 17 years. He was already fortified with the spiritual power to face all the great challenges that he would face in Mitzrayim. Why did he need another 17 years?
To learn Torah, perhaps.
Maybe, David, but I'm looking for...
And I think, like, as a test maybe to resist the influence of Mitzrayim.
Correct. What would be the test now in Mitzrayim? Yosef is now living in Mitzrayim as the leader of the people. Until now, he was a slave, and he faced all the challenges as an Evan. Now he rises to power, and he's the leader of Mitzrayim.
And he still kept everything.
Excellent. What would be the challenge to a leader like Yosef over Mitzrayim? Any leader, but especially Yosef.
Well,
I'm talking from a humanistic perspective. If you look at human history, and you talk about kings, I'm not a historian, but one thing I know, that every single leader is faced with the same challenge. And what is that?
Power gets to their head,
and they become tyrants, and they take advantage of the people, and they step on them. Yosef was in a glorious position. The entire world, and especially the world of Mitzrayim, depended upon Yosef. And the ethical system would have to be fine-tuned. Yosef would come to challenges like people who didn't have food, people who were willing to sell their land, and what would do with the land, and who would own the land, and how would he designate. He would have to come with an ethical system as a leader that would make sure to be fair to everyone. And the Meshech Chochma in last week's parasha says that the reason why Yosef broke down when his brothers showed up, if you remember, V'lo Yochel Yosef L'Sapek, says the Meshech Chochma, even though Yosef had vested interest to continue to press against his brothers in that terrible agenda that he had against his brothers, because he was waiting to see the fulfillment of his dream, when who would come down to Mitzrayim? When Yaakov the Shemesh would come down to Mitzrayim. But nevertheless, Lo Yochel L'Sapek. Says the Meshech Chochma, why? If Yosef Ratzel L'Sapek, why Lo Yochel L'Sapek? And you and I would have said he was emotionally overwhelmed by the presence of his brother, the impassioned plea of Yehuda at the beginning of Vayigash. Nein, says the Meshech Chochma, he was embarrassed in front of the Mitzrim, because the Mitzrayim knew that Yaakov was planting seeds against these people. They didn't know it was his brothers. They certainly know they didn't know that he sold them as an Eved. But there was something very strange over here. Here was Yaakov Avinu planting the Amtachas and the Gvira and framing these people, calling them, accusing them of espionage. What were they guilty of? Says the Meshech Chochmah, at that point, Yosef realized he couldn't continue. As much as he was in favor of continuing, because his plan was to fulfill that dream, he had to drop the ball. And why? Because he was the ethical teacher of the Mitzrayim. And he had to play that unique role, and they would call him an achzari. They would accuse him of being absolutely cruel, which a king very often, if power gets to his head, as you said, Chaim, a king would often do this. So here's this last 17 years of Yaakov's life. Here's where Yaakov plays the role again as a teacher. Chazal say, according to one opinion, that Yaakov taught Yosef on a regular basis during the 17 years. That's a very debatable question, and there are different opinions.
Oh, the Persian would say that they actually never met again.
That's right, because he was afraid he would ask him. There are many different, but according to one pshat, Yaakov Avinu continued to have an influence on Yosef. And why? Because now Yosef was facing a different set of challenges. Not the challenge of shiflus, of being the lowest slave as he was sold to his tribe, but the challenge of godless and romanus, that he is now in charge, he is the viceroy of the entire Mitzrayim. So therefore I submit to you that according to the Meshech Chochmah, I have no doubt that Yaakov continued his tremendous role as having an influence on Mitzrayim through the intermediary of his son Yosef. First he had an impact on Yosef, and then Yosef on Mitzrayim. In order to go on to the next piece in Rabbi Simcha, we open up the Chumash. I have a couple of copies of the Chumash here on the table so that you can see this inside. And we're going to take a look in the same chapter at Pasuk Lamed Aleph. Now, this is on page 118 if you have the big blue Chumashim. I don't know where it is in the art school. You have it on the table. And it says that Yosef has promised his father that he would take his remains and bury them in Eretz Canaan. Vayomer Yishav Ali, and Yaakov asks Yosef for an oath, Vayishav Alo, and then it says, Vayishtachu Yisrael al Rosh Habita, and then Yisrael, Yaakov Avinu, bows down, so to speak, to Yosef. I'm sorry, to Yosef. Now, let's read Rashi for a moment, because the Meshechof wants to embellish this Rashi. Rashi says, Dover Acher, again, he gives various different interpretations, which are not going to go through all of them. This is the third of a list of three. Al Rosh HaMita, Shehoisa Mitaso Shlema, V'lo Hoya Bo Resha. In other words, that amongst his 12 children, Yaakov had a situation called Mitaso Shlema. There wasn't one Rasha, one evildoer. Again, it could be the brothers were guilty, but they did tshuva. Shari Yosef Malachaya V'od, and furthermore, Shenishba Lebein Agoyim, even though he was the king, and as we said before, power could really ruin a king spiritually and ethically. But furthermore, he was amongst the Goyim, as you mentioned earlier, so he was surrounded by the influence of the Mitzrim. And nevertheless, Harehu Omed Bitzidko, he continued to be a tzaddik. So Yosef's Mita is mentioned here in this pasuk, Vayishtachu Yisrael Rosh HaMita, because his Mita, meaning all his offspring, where B'Shlemus were in a state of perfection, including Yosef. And here's where Rashi finds an excuse to praise Yosef, that he is not to be suspect of any rishus, and this despite the fact that he was under the constant influence of the Goyim of Mitzrayim. He was Omed B'Tzidko. Rabbi Simcha wants to add a piece here, which is very fascinating. Now, I may need your help here because I'm not so good at mathematics, but Rabbi Simcha wants to know, okay, This is a moment in Yosef's life, and he's still a good guy, you know, he's saintly, he's a tzaddik. Is Rashi indicating, when he says Omed Bitzitko, that just as Yosef had faced all the challenges of his life up until that point, we could say about Yosef that it'll be Omed Litzitko, Bitzitko, all his life. In other words, Rabbi Simcha wants to claim that perhaps what's hinted at in this Rashi is not just a description about Yosef at that moment in time, but that Yosef would never sin and he would always remain a tzaddik. That's a challenge. How could that be? How could you guarantee that Yosef would remain, as Rashi calls it, Omed Bitzidko? Because Rashi's not just describing that moment in time, but he's describing something about the very essence of Yosef. He is Tzadik Yisod Olam. He is the Tzadik personified, and he's Omed Bitzidko all of his life. Now, Rabbi Meir Simcha pulls a joker card out of his pocket. He's got a Gemara in Yuma. But before we see the Gemara in Yuma, let's do a little mathematics. How old is Yosef at this moment in time when Yaakov passes on? Says Rabbi Meir Simcha, let's go through the calculation. Yosef died at the age of 110. If you divide 110 into half, you get what? 55, correct? 55 times 2 is 110. That far I got in elementary mathematics. He says the following. The Pasuk tells us, back in Parshas Miketz, that Yosef was 35 years old when he stood in front of Paro. 35 years old, correct? Now, Yaakov is going to overlap with Yosef in Mitzrayim another 17 years, correct? How long is Yosef, how many years in Yosef's life will elapse between the time that he stands in front of Paro and the time that Yaakov comes down to Mitzrayim?
Less than 7.
9 years. Why? Because it's 7 years of plenty and 2 years of famine. And then Yaakov shows up in Mitzrayim. So let's add the following numbers. I need your help. 30, right? Because Yosef is 30 at the time that he stands in front of Paro. Add another 7 and you're up to 37. And add another 17.
Another 2, 7.
I'm sorry. Another, right, 7 and 2 is how much? 39. Is what? 39. And now we're going to add 17. How much is 17 and 39?
56.
Now, Yosef is going to die at the age of 110. So has most of his life passed at this point when Yaakov dies, or he still is in the first half of his life? Has he gotten to the second half, or is he still in the first half? Why, David? Yeah, I thought you were a better mathematician than I am. Now I'm really getting in trouble here. Either I'm really dumb, which is very possible, or you're really dumb, which is not possible. But let's just figure it out. Again, he's 30 plus 9 plus 17.
It's 56.
It's 56, and he's going to live to the age of 110. So if he's 56 at the time of his father's death, then more than half his life has passed by. So here's where Rabbi Simcha pulls out his card from his pocket. The Gemara says in Masechet Yoma that Avru Shanosav Shal Adam, I'm sorry, Avru Rov Shanosav Shal Adam, when a person passes his midway, the Lo Chata, and he hasn't seen, Chazaka Shalo Yichtashuv, we assume he will never sin again. And therefore, when Rashi says who Omed Bitzitko, Rashi's not talking about this particular moment in time, but that Yosef, we can be assured, will remain Omed Bitzitko because most of his life has already passed. It's Ovru Rov Shnosav Lo Chata, it's Chazak Sheshuv Lo Yechta. Now, how should I describe this piece? I mean, again, you know, you wonder how 3,300 years have passed since Matan Torah, and nobody thought of this idea, to figure out exactly if most of Yosef's life had already passed at the time of Yaakov Avinu's death, and to connect that with the Gemara and Yuma, and then come back to this Rashi of who Omer Fitzitko. I mean, it's really, really quite impressive. All right, let's go on. So now we're going to begin chapter Memches, Vayehi Achar HaDvarim HaEleh, Vayomer li Yosef, Hinei Avicha Choleh, So Yosef finds out, Rashi has a whole discussion, how he knew that Yaakov is on his deathbed. So Yosef brings his two sons, Menashe and Ephraim, to receive a bracha from Yaakov on his deathbed. Okay. So what happens first? Yaakov is about to do something amazing from the perspective of halacha, really a revolution from halachic perspective. We know that the land of Israel is going to be divided. Now, I want you to play a game with me now, if you don't mind, and give me the wrong answer. Okay, I want you to deliberately give me the wrong answer. The land of Israel is going to be divided up amongst how many shvatim?
12,
right? That should be the answer. But the answer is no. Why? Because of Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov Avinu is going to take Yosef, and he's going to divide him into two different shvatim. Now, we have to discuss these two different shvatim from the perspective of what's called a bachar, the firstborn, because these two shvatim, Menashe and Ephraim, who's the firstborn?
Menashe.
And yet, it would seem that Yaakov Avinu was more interested in Ephraim than he was in Menashe. But that's a subject that we'll get to in Mirtz Hashem later on. But right now, we have to figure out what's going on over here, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu promises the land of Israel to the Zerah of Yaakov, and Pashtus, it would seem that it should be divided equally. The only thing is that although Yerusha, an inheritance, is that an estate, whatever word you want to use, is according to Allah, is divided up equally, there's going to be a tremendous debate amongst the Tanoim back in the time of the Mishnah as to whether or not a father has the right to reapportion his land, his estate, in such a way that one of his sons will get more than the other. Okay, so we'll get back to that too. I'm just giving you a lot of information at once. Now, the only discrepancy in halacha between one of the heirs and the other is which? Is the, hello everybody? Bachar, correct? If you could help me out here when I ask for an answer, don't feel like I'm embarrassing you by asking you a stupid question. Just give me the answer, okay? Thank you. So the Bachar gets a double portion, correct? Now in the case of the Shiftei Ka, who is the Bachar by birth?
Ruvein.
But yet who would get the Pishnayim? Yosef. So basically, what Yaakov Avinu is revolutionizing here is the ability, first and foremost, to take away the Bachara from one son, who's the actual biological Bechor, and transfer it over to another son, such that now Yosef will get Pishnayim, he will receive the Bechor, the double portion.
Because he already did it with Esau. Like, it's not really the first time.
He meaning who? Yitzchak? Yeah, what are we talking
Yaakov
about? Yitzchak?
Kind of took the
Bechor. Oh, okay. But right now we're talking about physical possessions, real estate. You know, it's now in terms of what exactly Yaakov took away from Esau. I don't know. I have a strong suspicion that that's not a real estate issue. That's more of an issue of who will get the spiritual Bechor. What we're focusing on right now is a matter of real estate, because the territory of Eretz Yisrael is not that large. And if 12 tribes have the right to these territories, then again, we have to think about Levi, but leaving out Levi for a moment, 12 tribes, then if you're going to steal, so to speak, one of those 12s from one of the sons and give it to another, I mean, that's a violation of the law of Bechor, because the Bechor getting Pishnayim could only belong to Reuven.
Right.
So Rav Meir Simcha here in this third piece that we want to study today says the following. The Torah says at the end of Chumash, this is in Parshas Ki Tetze, Lo yuchal levaker es ben ha, what does it say over there? If somebody can do me a favor and open up the Chumash. What does it say? Open up for me the Chumash, because I like to read the Pasuk inside. We're in Perek Chof Aleph Pasuk Tet Zayin. Thank you, Chaim. Perek Chof Aleph Pasuk Tet Zayin. Chaim has helped me so much, he continues to help me. Okay, so in Parshas Ki Tetze, what does it say over there? Lo yuchal levaker. Okay, so this is in the aftermath of what's called the Eishes Yifas Toar, and without going into detail, he has two children, one from this wife, one from the other. He wants to give the Bechorah to one, to the child of one wife, and not to the other. And the Torah says he's not allowed to do this. This possible Yuchal Avaker is codified as one of the 613 mitzvahs. Now we know from many different sources, some of which Rabbi Simcha is going to quote here, that the Avos, even though they were before Matan Torah, they had the Torah in some form or another, and they were Mekayim the Torah. By the way, between me and Chaim, Rav Lichtenstein Zichron Levoch has a whole piece on what was the Torah like before the Torah was given. And it's called, Is There Ethics Beyond the Torah? I forgot exactly. It's mostly about Vasisa Yoshev HaTov, but it has a lot to do with this particular Meshech Chochma. I don't think he quotes this Meshech Chochma, but in any event, Hine, he says, behold, how could Yaakov plan to take away the Bechorah from Reuven and hand it over to Yosef and give Yosef's two children separate status as a Shevet? And the answer is, and that's what you would say to me, Lo Hoysa Oz Azhara Shalo Yuchal Avaker, that this pasuk that enjoins us, a father, from dividing up his land in such a way that somebody else other than the Bechorah would get Pishnayim, that's a prohibition. Well, that was not yet in effect. Why wasn't it in effect? Because it's before what? Before the Torah is given. Oh. Omnam, he says, no. That's not so simple. Because Becholzos, even if the lav, meaning the lotas, is not binding before the Torah is given, nevertheless, hoya oz din bechora. Whoa, this is like what we call briska lumbus. He wants to mechalik between the lav itself and the din bechora. The din bechora means some sort of the ethical right of the firstborn to get pishnayim. And that din b'chora, as an ethical right, should be equated to mat nachlos achar matan Torah. That just like the Torah, after it was given, prohibits shifting the b'char and the pishnayim from one to the other, ha'avos asu divreim al pi Torah. And Rav Kook ben Yair gives you a whole list of sources that the avos were mekayim the Torah. What does it mean they were mekayim the Torah? They weren't bound legally by the losases of the Torah, so you can't tell me that Lo Yuchal Avaker would apply to Yaakov Avinu before the Torah was given, but nevertheless, they were knowing, they accepted upon themselves Divreyam al Piyat Torah, they would act according to the Torah. So this rule of Lo Yuchal Levaker has two dimensions to it. Technically, legally, it's a lav like any other lav in the Torah, but in addition to that, there's a moral, ethical message that underlies Lo Yuchal Avaker. And the only time that the Avos would find fit to undermine the ethical laws of the Torah, im lo masharot sorech gadol lefi hazman, if there was some pressing issue, and they made a calculation that within the context of serving Hashem, they would have to set aside one or the other of the ethical laws of the Torah, only then would they do so. And Yaakov Avinu is going to marry
two wives?
Well, two wives is okay, by the way, David. Not that I'm not telling you to do that, but the Torah has no problem with two wives. I mean, Rabbeinu Gershom maybe had a problem, and I have a problem, but, you know, to one wife is enough. But two sisters. You're not allowed to marry two sisters. So there are 1,001 answers to this question, but Rabbeinu Simcha goes according to the Shita of the Ramban. In one place, the Ramban says, elsewhere he gives another answer, but that there was a Tzorek Gadol, that it was absolutely necessary for Yaakov to marry both Rachel and Leah. He really wanted to marry Rachel to build Klal Yisrael from Rachel, but as things would have, love and tricked him, and he had to build Klal Yisrael from two wives. I don't know if there are any other examples. Oh yeah, Amram marries Yocheved. Does anybody know the relationship between Amram and Yocheved?
A nephew and an aunt,
right? So yeah, Amram actually married his aunt, and again, there's going to be a long Maral Miprag in Parshas Vayigash to explain all these cases when the Avos would find Lefi Tzorek Gadol a need to override the moral law of the Torah. Lachen, hadin, what is the moral law of the Torah? Does a father have the right to move around his nachla? Let's forget about lo yuchal levakir. Let's see it in a broader context. Can a father bequeath to one of his sons a larger portion than the others? Says Rabbi Simcha, for that, you have to learn a sugya in Yesh Nochlin, which is a perek in Baba Basra, towards the end of Baba Basra. And there's a recorded machlokes, a debate between Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka and other Tanoim. We accept the opinion of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. And he says that Adam manchil ubonav kama sheyirtze, sheyir b'liechad, v'yamayit liechad. That a father has the right to do this, and he can shift around during his lifetime before he dies the Yerusha, the estate, and he could decide who is more Ra'i Lirash for any number of reasons. Maybe he thinks that this son is going to be the transmitter of Torah to the next generation. He chooses one son over the other, and morally and ethically he's allowed to do so. Again, once he dies, no one's going to write in a will for him, you know, once he's dead, meaning that now the state takes over, the halacha takes over, and every son will get an equal portion except for the Bechor. However, Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka says that this is something that a father should avoid until the very last day of his life. When he's on his deathbed, then he can decide what he believes, if he has a firm belief, is fair as far as dividing up his estate. As long as he's alive, this is going to generate a tremendous amount of enmity. So even though today, for example, Contemporary Life Day encourage you, I don't know if anybody here has ever done this, but some people, I guess, did, that you should write your estate. I was told that Yad Sarah has a whole section where if you want to go for free counseling, they'll tell you how to write your will, last will and testament. But in some certain sense, the halacha would encourage that you delay writing your last will and testament, but only again in this case where there's one son who's royally rash, that he really is the suitable. Again, for any number of reasons, he's the one who should get the lion's share of the estate. So that's called the Shechiv Meira, and therefore, the opening verse here of this entire chapter is Vayomer li Yosef hinei avicha choleh. What does that mean, hinei avicha choleh? Exactly, there's a Shechiv Meira. And it's critical that the Torah opens up this portion, says the Marbeir Simcha. And again, I don't believe anyone ever thought of this for 3,300 years. Everybody would interpret that this means that Yosef got the word that it's time to bring his sons for a bracha. Nay. This goes beyond that. The Torah wants to set up a moral and ethical basis or a license for why Yaakov Avinu now needs to bring in the sons of Yosef and determine and establish that they are Shvatim, just like the other Shvatim, which we'll see in a Pasuk. Which Pasuk is that? Alright, we'll get to it in a minute. Is Lokach Menashe v'Ephraim v'Hizmin HaKadosh Baruch Hu Din Menashe and Ephraim. Now, why is Menashe and Ephraim very, very important here? The answer is because you can interpret a father's decision to reallocate his estate on his deathbed in two different ways. One way, again, this is just Burzon, I'm calling it favoritism. You know, this son did a lot for me. You know, he was really my loyal servant. He never questioned me, had a great deal of respect, etc., etc. That's called favoritism. But in the case of Menashe and Ephraim, this is not favoritism. This is because Yaakov, in his great insight, his Ruach HaKodesh, he knew that Menashe and Ephraim would play tremendous roles contributing to the building of Knesset Yisrael. So his decision was not based on some capricious decision of favoritism, but rather it was based on a serious, serious decision. And now he's going to reallocate the land of Eretz Yisrael. If you take a look for a moment in the footnotes here, he says in footnote number 10, Rav Kuperman writes, Haresha Sidurei HaBechora, the shifting in the Bechora, in which Yaakov Avinu upgrades Yosef to have a double portion through Menashe and Ephraim, Al Yidei Avos, Nasu Mitoch Shikulim Mahutiyim Amitiyim, V'lo Mitoch Aflaya. Aflaya means favoritism. So it was a matter of a serious decision in terms of the essence and the truth of who should be considered a Shevet and who not. Laharos, and this is the way that Yaakov demonstrates when he chooses Menashe Ephraim, Ki lo me'avas Rachel. It's not because he loves Rachel more than he loves Leah, and therefore he wants to bestow upon Rachel's descendants a greater status. O mipchisus Leah, because he didn't have that love for Leah, so heviar b'chorim Ruven. Ruven was the descendant, was the son of Leah, Li Yosef, who is the son of Rachel. No. It wasn't because of some favoritism, because he was in love with Rachel, and he didn't have that same relationship with Leah. Darei Menashe v'Ephraim he me'em achas u'b'chol zos v'yosem es Ephraim lifnei Menashe. You see that everything in this parasha that motivates Yaakov Avinu in a very strange, aberrant behavior is because of shikulim mahutiyim amitiyim, as Rav Koopman calls it, because he chooses Ephraim above Menashe, not because he loved Ephraim's mother more than he loved Menashe's mother, because both Ephraim and Menashe had the same mother, but rather because he felt that Ephraim was going to be the ultimate leader of Knesset Yisrael. For example, who would come from Ephraim? Yoshua, the great Yoshua. And therefore Yaakov Avinu chooses Ephraim, and there are many reasons why he chooses Ephraim. He says, "V'davar anemar al yedei navi eino yochel ishtanos mitova." Now, here at this point, Rabbi Simcha wants to understand the sequence of psukim. It says that Yaakov turns to Yosef when Yosef comes in on his deathbed, and he says, "Kel shakai nirei lai beluz." God appeared to me in a place called Luz, Be'eretz Kanan, Vayivarech Osi. And all of a sudden, Yaakov feels compelled to transmit to Yosef the divine promise that Almighty God had revealed to Yosef, to Yaakov, back in Eretz Canaan. Vayomer Eli, God said to me, "Hineni mafricha v'bisicha, you're going to have many children, many descendants. Nasaticha lekal amim, and then v'nasati es haaretz azos." I promise the land of Canaan, that's where Yaakov had received this revelation, so that Yaakov understood from this divine promise and that revelation that God was promising the land of Israel, in other words, as a Yerusha, as an inheritance of the land of Israel for all eternity. And now, after sharing that message, which seems to be irrelevant, he gets back to the main order of business. And that is, V'ata, Shnei Banecha Noladim L'cham Eretz Mitzrayim, your two sons, he says, Liam Ephraim Menashe Kiruve V'Shimon Yehuli, means they will be Shvatim, and they will inherit the land, two portions. Both portions are equal to any single portion of any of the other brothers, any of the Shvatim, and they get a double portion. Then he goes on, Yaakov Avinu, to talk about the fact that Rachel was not buried in Eretz Yisrael. Why didn't Yaakov Avinu bury Rachel in Eretz Canaan? He goes on to say that what Yaakov was trying to transmit to Yosef was a nevuah letova. What does that mean? There are two categories, says Rabbi Simcha, of prophecy, and they're fundamentally different one from the other. One prophecy is l'ra'ah, it foretells evil. The other is a prophecy l'tova, that foretells something good. And the difference between them is whether yochel ishtanos or any yochel ishtanos. In the case of a nevuah l'ra'ah, if it's an evil, for then the Navi is not held responsible for the fulfillment of that nevuah. It's very possible that nevuah, that prophecy l'ra'ah, will never come to pass. Anybody remember which example you could give?
Ninveh
Yom HaKippurim Yonah. However, nevuah l'tova is something that we can use to test the Navi, to see whether he's a Navi Emes or a Navi Sheker, because a nevuah l'tova, once it's transmitted to the Navi to tell us something, foretell something about others, about people or nations, then Eino yochel ishtanos. There's no way that it could change. All the occasions that we find, says Rabbi Simcha, in which the others were afraid that maybe the divine promise would not come to pass, those were a different kind of nevuah. That was a nevuah letova liatzmo. That was a private conversation that was only relevant to the recipient himself, but not to transmit to others. It wasn't relevant to others. So Yaakov Avinu could always be afraid, what's called Shema Yigrom HaChet, that if he sins, maybe HaKadosh Baruch Hu would rescind the promise. But this particular nevuah could never be rescinded. And the reason why is because it says, L'zarecha acherecha. God is promising the land of Israel, not just to Yaakov, but L'zarecha acherecha. And therefore, when we find back in Parshas Vayetze, the Torah says that God promised Yaakov l'chat nena, Yaakov Avinu doesn't reiterate that. That's not relevant. Because Yaakov knows that l'chat nena is avtocha li'atzmo, that God is addressing Yaakov and he says, you will receive the land of Israel. But Yaakov Avinu wants to prove to Yosef that the giving of this gift of the land of Israel is permanent, it's eternal, and it's irrevocable. And how does he prove it? From the fact that it says l'zarecha acherecha. Hare nemar al yidei navi lizaro. If this nevuah was given to a navi lizaro, then eino yochel ishtanos. V'havi kimuchsak. It's as if the land of Israel is already ours. You can imagine that the promise of God that the descendants of Yaakov would receive the land, consider it a done deal. It's already kimuchsak. And perhaps Rabbi Simcha has in mind the Gemara at the end of Avasa that says Eretz Yisrael muchzekasi lanu me'avoseinu, that already at the time of the Avos, we the people of Israel had a chazaka in the land. And that's one of the reasons why, okay, I don't want to get off on a tangent, but a ger who converts to Judaism, he may be able to recite the Parsha Bikurim, because, or I should say just the opposite, that a Jew is able to recite the Parsha Bikurim because he can say Ha'aretz Asher Nasata Li, even though he didn't receive the land because it was given to the Avos. Lachain, if Yaakov Avinu has a promise which cannot be revoked, and therefore Yaakov Avinu already has a chazak on the land, then we can activate the principle of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka that a father has the right to divvy up his land. He can take his estate and he can divide it up. What do you mean he can divide up his estate? He doesn't own Eretz Yisrael. How can Yaakov even have the legal rights to grant Ephraim and Manasseh equal portions in the land when the land doesn't belong to him? The answer is it does belong to him by virtue of the prophecy, which is now irreversible. That's why Yaakov Avinu was very careful to transmit to Yosef as an introduction to V'yata Shnei Banecha Noladi Ephraim Menashe Keruv Shimon Yili, this introduction that God said to him, not L'chat Nena, which is a Parshas Vayetze, but this unique nevuah that he receives on his way down to when he's about to embark and leave Eretz Canaan to Mitzrayim. Hini mafricha mavrecha v'nasati l'cha v'nasati es ha'aretz hazos l'zarecha acherecha. And l'zarecha acherecha makes it into a nevuah which is relevant to others, not just to Yaakov but to his zera, and therefore it's eino yochel ishtanos, it cannot be changed. And therefore, on his deathbed, Yaakov Avinu, even though he obliged all the moral teachings of the Torah, and he would not violate them, what we call the dinim of the Torah, not the lavim of the Torah, because he's not yet obligated under the law, but he's committed to the din Torah. And if morally and ethically he's not allowed to do this, then why would Yaakov embark on this? The answer is he's morally okay, because we paskin like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, that when a man has an estate on his deathbed, he can reallocate and shift the balance of his estate. And Yaakov Avinu now, v'nasati it's as if he already owns Eretz Yisrael. No sin could ever undermine this and void this promise. Because you have something called ra'ui, and ra'ui you're not allowed to shift around. What's ra'ui? Okay, for this we'd have to learn Perikei Shnochalin. But let's say, for example, if my father owns land, okay, that's not a great example. What example could I give? Let's see, where you yoreish something after a period of time. Okay, let's say, for example, somebody owes me money. That's called a loan, right? I haven't collected that money. Rabbi Yochanan Mevrocha says that money is not mine to divvy up. I can't decide who's going to get that loan. Because until that loan is paid, it's only ra'ui. Ra'ui means it's theoretical. But it's not actual. You don't have an actual ownership of it. So you and I would have said that Eretz Yisrael, from Yaakov's perspective, is only called ra'ui. Meaning, in the future, down the line, the descendants of Yaakov would inherit the land. But if it's only Roy, then the father has no right to divvy up his estate. But the answer is no. Eretz Yisrael, from Yaakov's perspective, is not Roy, it's not potential, it's actual, it's real, it's Muchzak, and that's because he got this Nevuah of Lezarecha, and that Nevuah is a Nevuah Letova for someone else, and Eino Yochel Lishtanos. Okay, Rabosai, I was able to learn with you about half of what I prepared for tonight, but that's the way it goes. I hope you're beginning to appreciate, as I am, Rav Simcha, Rav Meir Simcha. I mean, the man is unbelievably creative. If you take these pages home and you'll study them on your own, I wish you a lot of luck, because his text is very challenging. I spend a lot of time to lefaneach at that text, to take it apart, but you'll get a lot out of it. He has a lot to say about Ephraim uMenashe in this particular section of Parshas Vayechi, and then he goes on with other sections of Parshas Vayechi. It's one of the longest Meshech Chachmas that goes on for like 20 pages. I wish everyone a great week, and thanks for coming. Anyone who wants to learn a little Shvilei Pinchas with me, we'll start in about 3 minutes. Amir Shem. If anyone has any questions or comments, now's a good time. Tony, I want to show you something. Look at that.
Sorry?
Do you know why I'm showing this to you?
No.
This was the machine that a year ago fell.
More than a year ago.
More than a year
ago. 3 years ago.
And we never saw anything on the screen.
And I was going to get you a replacement.
Don't figure.
3 years.